broadcast the decibel to reveal what these documents finally told us.
These documents explained why the government dismissed these two scientists. This whole episode began in 2018, according to these documents, when the public health agency suddenly learns that she's a listed inventor of a Chinese patent that, in fact, may contain research she did at the Winnipeg lab. She and Mr. Cheng had essentially lied, covered up, and refused to reveal the full scale of their cooperation with China until evidence was presented to them.
Wow.
Part of the documents that were released were the CSIS investigation, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. You know, the documents revealed what it called a close and clandestine relationship with a variety of entities in the People's Republic of China. One thing they found out, for instance, is that Dr. Chu had a whole different resume, a whole different CV in China compared to the one she used in Canada. They discovered she had a bank account in China that she hadn't revealed. She was approved to participate in a project at Wuhan Virology Institute that would look at cross-species infection and pathogenic risks of bat filoviruses. Work that the service said suggests gain-of-function studies were possibly to take place. She also said an October 2018 trip to China that she had told her employers was a personal vacation. She later acknowledged, after being presented with the evidence, that their trip was paid for by the Wuhan Institute for Virology. CSIS discovered that Chu was nominated for an International Cooperation Award by China's Academy of Military Medical Sciences for using Canada's Level 4 biosecurity lab as a base to assist China. CSIS said she was reckless in her dealings with institutions whose goals have potentially lethal military applications that are manifestly not in the interest of Canada or its citizens.
Okay. Sounds like we learned a few things.
Right. It was very interesting, but it took so long to come out. I think that it didn't have a big impact, but it actually is a very important report, a very important document.
Yeah, this was everywhere when it was happening. It was a major scandal. We talk about foreign interference in terms of like election interference, which is concerning, but the notion that like this is one of the biggest questions in the world about coronavirus. And a very strong concerning like, wow, we have a level four lab here in Winnipeg and they have this level four lab in Wuhan. These were legitimate questions. And I think the press was all over it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Globe comes out with not full answers, but quite a bit of substantiation here. I mean, she was working on gain of function. That is research into helping viruses get more potent.
And I find it really interesting that she's working in such a sensitive area. And she goes back to China, which is setting up this very similar lab in Wuhan. Canada was ahead of the Wuhan lab. Wuhan did not know how to create this high security bio level lab, and she was helping them. And of course, China is not a democracy. China is a dictatorship. China has all kinds of designs on the South China Seas and Taiwan. It's not an ally. It looks like Canada was very, very, very lax in monitoring her.
Kudos to Steve Chase for sticking on this. I mean, seems like a pretty obvious one for media to stay on when others have lost interest in one of the biggest questions in the world. I will note, though, in you know, kind of like in Globe and Mail fashion, he doesn't get ahead of himself, but he doesn't even touch the issue. He kind of lays out, here's what the documents tell us, which point very strongly to this other conversation about where coronavirus comes from, but he does not engage with that question. Does Dr. Chu, does this national security breach, this research, does it have a connection with the coronavirus? And, you know, my best guess is because it's not verified. He can't substantiate any solid links. He just avoids the topic entirely.
Yeah, he shouldn't avoid the topic because there is no substantiated link. No one can find it. But partly that's because China has not cooperated with the delegations from the UN and from the West who want to look at that lab, the virology lab in Wuhan, because that lab is very close to the food market in Wuhan where they found early COVID transmission. So they have not cooperated, but it's a huge cloud over this. The Chinese scientist, Dr. Chu, was working on Ebola and made big successes in Ebola, which of course is not COVID, but there is this COVID link with Wuhan, right? That's mm-hmm. where we know that it started. There have always been questions of where did this COVID virus come from? And this has not been answered. So I guess Steve Chase or the Globe editors decided, well, we just can't talk about it. But actually, I think you should talk about it. I think you need to talk about it and make it clear that you're not saying it is, but you have to ask all the questions. You might not have all the answers, but a good journalist should always ask all the questions to at least let the reader or the listener know, yeah, we're aware of this, we're thinking of this, but this is all we have at the moment. You shouldn't just not mention it. It's a very important story because this is one lab, this is a couple of Chinese scientists, but I think it's happening not just in Canada, but all over the world. This is part of China's push to get knowledge and technology back to China. And they have a program. It's called the Thousand Talents Program. But they pay the scientists here in the West to recruit ethnic Chinese scientists who may or may not be Chinese citizens, but usually are not. They pay them to get the information. And in the U.S., they arrested somebody who was getting a payment from this talent program and didn't disclose it. And this scientist in Canada, Dr. Chu, she was involved in this program too. Mm-hmm. So it's quite nefarious.
And they didn't arrest her here. She and her husband, I think their kids, they got away and they're in China.
How do you know that? I just know that no one has found her. How do you know she's in China?
The Globe reports that their house in Winnipeg is abandoned and that she showed up in Chinese research and she showed up on Chinese social media.
On WeChat. But I can use WeChat here. It doesn't mean I'm in China. Her house is rented out.
Uh-huh.
And the tenants communicate with her, the owner, by WeChat. But anybody can be on WeChat. I don't know where she is. I assume she's in China, but listen to this. China does not allow dual citizenship. She had to be a Canadian citizen, I believe, to work in that lab. And she talked about how happy she was to be a Canadian. So she's a Canadian citizen. And of course, she can go live in China. And you're probably right. That's probably where she is.
No, I think you're right to check me there, because that was the suggestion and the insinuation I took from the Globe, kind of like, here are all the footprints of her being in China.
Right.
And I took from that, oh, she's in China. But actually, you're correct. They do not actually conclude that they can't place her there. What she's not is in custody here in Canada, where they could question her and get to the bottom of this. So, Jan, unlike in America, where they actually laid charges, I don't believe that Dr. Chu has ever been charged with anything, but she has disappeared.
I think you're right. I wish someone would find her.
It's kind of a thriller, isn't it? Like, it's international intrigue. But, you know, we did a couple of episodes about daring to look at this very controversial and conspiracy-laden thing of, like, where did coronavirus come from? And has this been so muddied and clouded up with lies and conspiracy theory that we'll never know? And we did an episode with Elaine Dewar, who wrote a book about this, and another one with scientist Angie Rasmussen, who kind of presented two different points of view on this. I don't know at all which one is correct, but my understanding is that we are still at a point where the lab leak theory is still a very likely contender for where this came from. And are we ever going
to
know?
But to point out, China was one of the earliest and most severely hit by the COVID virus, right?
Which suggests that whether this was being developed, you know, if we're going to take this hypothesis, whether it was being developed as a biological weapon or for legitimate purposes, this was not unleashed upon the world as an act of biological warfare, but as an accident.
Yeah, which is really interesting. And in Wuhan, where they have this level 4 lab, which they were putting together, you know, based on help from this Winnipeg Chinese scientist. So it's so fascinating. And it's such a pain that the government took so long to release it, because I think they were embarrassed.
For sure.
Because as you point out, very little was redacted. So what were they hiding? Why did it take so long?
Well, we look like clowns. You know, like, she was not a very sophisticated international agent. She was going back and forth, applying for grants, putting her name on patents. Like, if her level of subterfuge is like leaving a few credentials off of her CV, and she was able to function here for almost two decades.
Yeah, we look pathetic. Our security looks pathetic. Our government looks pathetic. And you know what? I think it's just the whole notion of being Canadian. We ask her, oh, you're on these patents in China. She goes, oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, bye. Have a nice day. See you later.
Jan, let us duly note a bunch of things that people need to know more about. I'm going to kick us off here. people should be more familiar with our FOI, whatever you want to call it, ATIP system, our Freedom of Information system in Canada than they are. One aspect of our access to information system is that as hard as it is to request information from the government, I'll leave aside all the frustrations about how long it takes to get documents, it takes a long time, and how redacted they are. But once the government has provided that, it's supposed to be easier for the next person who needs that same information or wants it. They can piggyback the initial request. And that's also supposed to save the bureaucracy from having to go through the whole thing again. However, to actually do that is itself a bureaucratic hurdle, and people don't really have an easy way of finding out what requests have been made and what they can piggyback. And then once the documents are released, it's not easy to access those already released documents. And that's why the Globe and Mail rolled out this project called Secret Canada in 2022. And they rolled this out with all the fanfare of a Globe and Mail, you know, Michelin Award targeted piece of very serious enterprise. It had graphic design, it had videos, and it was not just articles about the access to information system and what was being revealed, but it was a resource where you could search through all of the documents the government had released and see if there was something. You could search for a keyword, see if you're in there. The thing is, all you could get from it was that a document existed.
Oh, that's useless. Yeah, that's no good.
And then it would like link you to the page you could go to, then go request it yourself. When they were revealing this and rolling it out, Robin Doolittle explained, like, it's just impossible. She said, like, we can't do that. It's a non-starter. I'm quoting from what she wrote. For one thing, it would be astronomically expensive, as public bodies would probably want to re-vet each file. Even aggregating already posted documents had to be scratched from our wish list when we got back quotes about how much this would cost to store tens of thousands of PDFs. And the number would grow exponentially each year. So we regrouped and we decided the next best thing was to make it as easy as possible for people to get the documents themselves. And so that's what we did. It's not perfect, but it's workable, is what Robin Doolittle said. Fair enough, I guess. But you know what just happened?
What?
This tiny little outfit that just launched not long ago, the Investigative Journalism Foundation, they did it. So if listeners don't remember, we've talked about them before, but the Investigative Journalism Foundation is the very small nonprofit that launched not long ago at all, and it's just a handful of journalists doing public interest investigative journalism. They just launched Open by Default, and they have online the full documents for 20,000 and growing completed federal access to information documents.
Wow. That's great.
How could they do that? The Globe and Mail has billionaires funding the Globe and Mail. So this tiny little investigative journalism foundation has it. And so what did I do? I searched for myself.
Of course you did.
The government might not have had files on Dr. Chu, but they do have files on Jesse Brown. I don't know if you could call these files. I don't keep like the Jesse Brown file, but I mentioned again and again, the RCMP has me. They're really just doing media monitoring of like what people are saying about the RCMP. But when I was like in Saskatchewan doing a panel on how the RCMP mismanaged the Colton Bushy killing, they were like watching me to see what I was saying and what my forum, what my panelists were saying around the We Charity stuff, the Kielburgers. Government was keeping files on that. Like, it's really interesting to see what they find interesting.
Anything about themselves they find interesting.
That's it. I'm searching for myself, and they're searching for themselves. And that's the world right now. Everybody just searches for themselves.
Duly noted.
Jan, what would you like to duly note?
I have to duly note something that isn't going to happen. So this week, China announced that the premier would no longer hold a press conference at the end of the legislative session that's just started. Now, I have to unpack some of that. When China has a legislative session, it's not like a Western democracy legislative. It's not really. It's just a lot of meetings. So for the past 30 years, they've always had this press conference at the end of the legislative session. And now suddenly they've announced they're not. And some Western media are wringing their hands and going, oh, we have so little access. Now we don't even have this. And I would just like to say, good. I'm glad they're not having a press conference because it was all crap anyway. And it was window dressing to make the Chinese government look like it was a normal government, that where it would have, you know, leaders talking to the press after a big event. But also, people are saying, Western experts are saying, this shows that Xi Jinping is getting stronger and trying to keep the premier out of the limelight. And I would say, actually, this shows how frail and fragile Xi Jinping is. Not that he's strong, but that he's getting nervous.
Huh.
He promoted this person strictly on the basis of loyalty. This has been Xi Jinping. He's been doing an extraordinary job of amassing 100% of the power. And for him to cut Li Qiang's press conference out, it means he doesn't want to give him any attention. And that's, I think, usually because someone's afraid of you, not because someone's confident. And finally, I'd like to say that when I was a reporter in Beijing for 6 years, I tried to avoid press conferences at all costs because they were a total waste of time. You were like a potted plant. You were just there to give the illusion of a free press. And I have a friend named Jimmy Flor Cruz, who was, I guess, the Newsweek correspondent. And he's Filipino, so of course he gets mistaken for a Chinese. And he told me that when he went to one of these big meetings as a journalist, somebody handed him an envelope. And he didn't think anything of it. He went to his seat, and then he opened it up. And inside was cash, because they thought he was a Chinese reporter.
Uh-huh.
And they were paying him cash. And I think, God damn it, that's the only time I didn't go. I should have gone and got my cash. So I just think it's actually progress not to have those stupid press conferences. And I'd like to point out that, I guess last week, Biden sent out Kamala Harris. We never hear from Kamala Harris, right?
Mm-hmm.
But last week when she had to ask for a temporary ceasefire in Gaza, which is like very unpopular, probably going to fail, he sent out Kamala Harris because he doesn't want to wear the failure. So anytime a leader sort of lets the deputy talk or not talk, it's always significant and it's never what you think.
Duly noted. Jan, we end today's episode on a somber note. A Canadian giant has passed.
We have some breaking news to share with you. Canada's 18th Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Brian Mulroney, has died.
On Parliament Hill, flags are lowered to half-mast and a book of condolences set out to mark the death of a Canadian political giant.
On this Friday night, honouring former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney.
He was a man of enormous gifts.
His undeniable influence on Canada and beyond.
The glorification continues in written headlines. Here's Globe and Mail editorial. Brian Mulroney, the last great Prime Minister. National Post, every politician found something to like about Brian Mulroney. Policy Magazine, a transcendent talent for friendship. The Toronto Star, Brian Mulroney knew the ravages of alcohol and was there for anyone struggling, including me. Ottawa Citizen, how I came to love former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. Globe and Mail again, Canada's great deal maker. Brian Mulroney thought big, took risks, and played for keeps. National Post, the post-politics wit of Brian Mulroney. I'm going to go on.
No, stop, please, enough.
Again, CBC, a born politician with a gift for connecting. Tom Mulcair, he was one of a kind. Global News.
Oh, God.
The greatest PM in Atlantic Canada. Global News again, a transformational leader. Chen Wong, I had no idea. I'm, you know, condolences to the family. I don't mean to any disrespect.
Of course.
I had no idea.
No, and you know what? I'm getting a flashback. When Chairman Mao died, this is what happened. Everything was, he was the greatest ever, blah, 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 blah. No, no, no. This is ridiculous. Well, I'm speaking as a journalist. It's ridiculous. I don't understand what's going on with the Canadian media.
Now, let's be fair here, Jan, because, you know, journalists care about facts, and the facts are that Brian Mulroney's legacy was not just purely a one-sided campaign of glory. They're, you know, the Globe and Mail did say in a headline that he was one of the most divisive prime ministers, which seems to be just a point of fact when you think about the response to the GST and free trade. That's what they said in a headline in a tweet, that he was one of the most divisive prime ministers. And then they retracted it. They said it does not meet their editorial standards. They retracted the word. He was just divisive. He could have been divisive and right. But, like, I remember that when the angry crowds on the streets of Canada were there protesting Brian Mulroney and free trade, calling him a traitor. And this is what it sounded like before he died. And we do this when politicians die in Canada. But before he died, Mulroney's relationship with the press did not sound quite as chummy or respectful. Here are some sounds over the years of Mulroney and the press.
Brian Mulroney, 1,584.
Brian Mulroney, the new Tory chief, made his first appearance as an MP. And it turned out to be quite a show.
What was demeaning, according to these jerks on the loony left, were the idea of two Irish guys singing When Irish Eyes Are Smiling on St. Patrick's Day. How silly and insecure can you be?
Mulroney referred to Bryce Mackesy's appointment as ambassador to Portugal. His comment last Saturday was, "Let's face it, there's no whore like an old whore. If I had been in Bryce's position, I'd have been right in there with my nose in the public trough like the rest of them."
And I woke up the next morning, and there in 8-column headlines and the Toronto Star was the most vicious personal attack. The loony left, you know, you gotta love them. What a nutty bunch.
The Airbus Mulroney-Karlheinz Schreiber saga, it must be running now longer than The Simpsons. Take a bow, Sideshow Bob.
Distinguished members of the press gallery, mesdames et messieurs, good evening. Peter Newman, go yourself. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and good night.
Jen, I believe you were working in the Globe and Mail newsroom throughout the Mulroney years. Do you remember that Mulroney, the one who told the journalist to go f*** himself?
Yeah, but I didn't really cover politics then. I remember him as an average Canadian remembers him. He's for free trade. He brought in the GST. He did fight apartheid. He led the international move, and that was excellent that he did that. But, you know, he was corrupt. I don't know why we don't say that. He took bags of cash. He put them in his safe. He did not report it to the tax people. And he's a trained lawyer. So he's corrupt. And we don't say that. Too bad that headline didn't say he was the most corrupt prime minister. And then they took it down.
You know, Jan, I know your political agenda, but this is a journalistic environment here, and we hew closely to facts. And the cash was not in bags; it was in envelopes.
Oh no, really?
Are you
sure it's not in a bag? Yeah, okay, envelope, because he put it in his shirt. That's right, in his jacket.
At least $225,000. I read somewhere $300,000.
Yeah, at least $225,000
delivered in a Manila envelope from a German arms dealer named Karlheinz Schreiber. Like, if you were writing a Simpsons cartoon about what corruption looks like, like, it was just so piddly and it was so embarrassing that the former Prime Minister of Canada, like, a well-compensated rest of his life, getting big checks from law firms and from consultation, like, no need to take down the office and the stature of the country for a Manila envelope payoff from Karlheinz Schreiber and attacking journalists for trying to get to the bottom of it.
By the way, they were $1,000 bills, which the Mint no longer prints because it was too easy for drug dealers and people like former prime ministers to take cash payments. So that's why you can't get a $1,000 bill anymore.
I come not to bury or to praise. I just feel like we can do both, or like you just tell what happened, which is like, yeah, that, like, he does seem like, and I think that like sometimes time just does this. Like, even George W. Bush started looking like more of a statesman in time. I mean, that's wild.
Well, relative to Trump, that's the only reason.
Yeah. So time will do this. What was the, I won't requote the old whore. Anyhow.
There's no fucking old whore.
Look, I do get it that, given the crop of politicians we have now, people are looking at Mulroney's passing and seeing, like, he seems like a big figure. And a lot of this, you've just been living with him in your brain as a prime minister of history. But no, like, it's worth remembering the stand he took on apartheid, which was not the stand that Reagan and Thatcher were taking. You know, he had moral leadership. He was a persuasive guy. He had this thing with journalists where he would, like, call you up and make you feel like you were his buddy and, like, talk your ear off.
So pathetic. Journalists are pathetic.
I think so. A skilled politician, definitely had more charisma and that baritone, you know, that you mentioned. Like, you know, I get why we have cause to remember, and we should. It's part of our own sort of like national pride to remember that we had leaders. But like, he did some other stuff too.
Mm-hmm. And I think that this point about journalism, that we sort of lose our minds when someone dies. And I used to teach obituaries when I was teaching in Fredericton journalism. Mm-hmm. And everybody always thought, oh, you can't say anything bad of the dead. And that's what your Victorian era aunt would tell you. Do not speak ill of the dead. But an obituary is a news story.
Yes.
And it is not paid by the family death notice. It's a story about a person's life. You have to adhere to the facts and it has to be balanced. And a balanced obituary of Brian Mulroney would say that he was divisive. And that he was on the take. That was the name of Stevie Cameron's book. I mean, she did amazing reporting about him. And, you know, they went after her for that.
They sure did. you know, the retraction is an embarrassment. To retract that story is an embarrassment.
It's an embarrassment. Why would the Globe retract a tweet that said he was divisive? He was divisive. He did win the biggest landslide in Canadian electoral history, but it didn't last very long. But that's so Canadian, right? And yet when he dies, we talk about this icon. And I don't think so. I think he was a man who won a big election and took money and did good things and bad things.
I think that any fair obituary would talk about his scandals and his failures. Like, you know, Meech Lake happened.
There's no excuse for the way they've written about Mulroney's death.
We tend to get carried away.
Yeah, we get carried away.
Jan, thank you for joining me. That was Shortcuts.
That was so much fun. Thank you for inviting me on.
Listen, I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything people send. Jan Wong, where can people find you?
Well, they can write to me on my website, www.janwong.ca, or I'm still on Twitter. So embarrassing. @writerwong.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production coordinator is Andre Proop, and our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.